Chapter 116. I say, apostrophe repeated Mr. Phipps, that I don't know it's a matter of much consequence. The business lies entirely between yourself and me, Mr. Pinch. With reference to your duties, I can set you going, and with reference to your salary, I can pay it. Weekly, apostrophe said Mr. Phipps, putting down the wafer stamp, and looking at John Westlock and Tom Pinch by turns, weekly, in this office, at any time between the hours of 4 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Apostrophe as Mr. Phipps said this, he made up his face, as if he were going to whistle. But he didn't. You are very good, apostrophe said Tom, whose countenance was now suffused with pleasure. And nothing can be more satisfactory or straightforward. My attendance will be required, apostrophe, from 9:30 to 4 o'clock or so, I should say, apostrophe interrupted Mr. Phipps. About that, apostrophe, I did not mean the hours of attendance, apostrophe retorted Tom, which are light and easy, I am sure, but the place. Apostrophe, oh, the place. The place is in the temple. Apostrophe, Tom was delighted. Perhaps, apostrophe said Mr. Phipps, you would like to see the place? Apostrophe, oh dear. Apostrophe, cried Tom. I shall only be too glad to consider myself engaged, if you will allow me, without any further reference to the place. Apostrophe, you may consider yourself engaged, by all means, apostrophe said Mr. Phipps. You couldn't meet me at the Temple Gate in Fleet Street, in an hour from this time, I suppose, could you? Apostrophe, certainly Tom could. Good, apostrophe said Mr. Phipps, rising. Then I will show you the place, and you can begin your attendance tomorrow morning. In an hour, therefore, I shall see you. You too, Mr. Westlock? Very good. Take care how you go. It's rather dark. Apostrophe, with this remark, which seemed superfluous, he shut them out upon the staircase, and they groped their way into the street again. The interview had done so little to remove the mystery in which Tom's new engagement was involved, and had done so much to thicken it, that neither could help smiling at the puzzled looks of the other. They agreed, however, that the introduction of Tom to his new office and office companions could hardly fail to throw a light upon the subject, and therefore postponed its further consideration until after the fulfillment of the appointment they had made with Mr. Phipps. After looking at John Westlock's chambers, and devoting a few spare minutes to the Boar's Head, they issued forth again to the place of meeting. The time agreed upon had not quite come, but Mr. Phipps was already at the Temple Gate, and expressed his satisfaction at their punctuality. He led the way through sundry lanes and courts, into one more quiet, and more gloomy than the rest, and, singling out a certain house, ascended a common staircase, taking from his pocket, as he went, a bunch of rusty keys. Stopping before a door upon an upper story, which had nothing but a yellow smear of paint, where custom would have placed the tenant's name, he began to beat the dust out of one of these keys, very deliberately, upon the great broad handrail of the balustrade. You had better have a little plug made, apostrophe he said, looking round at Tom, after blowing a shrill whistle into the barrel of the key. It's the only way of preventing them from getting stopped up. You'll find the lock go the better too, I dare say, for a little oil. Apostrophe, Tom thanked him, but was too much occupied with his own speculations, and John Westlock's looks, to be very talkative. In the meantime Mr. Phipps opened the door, which yielded to his hand very unwillingly, and with a horribly discordant sound. He took the key out, when he had done so, and gave it to Tom. Apostrophe, said Mr. Phipps. The dust lies rather thick here. Apostrophe, truly, it did. Mr. Phipps might have gone so far as to say, very thick. It had accumulated everywhere, lay deep on everything, and in one part, where a ray of sun shone through a crevice in the shutter, and struck upon the opposite wall, it went twirling round and round, like a gigantic squirrel cage. Dust was the only thing in the place that had any motion about it. When their conductor admitted the light freely, and lifting up the heavy window sash, let in the summer air, he showed the moldering furniture, discolored wainscoting and ceiling, rusty stove, and ashy hearth, in all their inert neglect. Close to the door there stood a candlestick, with an extinguisher upon it, as if the last man who had been there had paused, after securing a retreat, to take a parting look at the dreariness he left behind, and then had shut out light and life together, and closed the place up like a tomb. There were two rooms on that floor, and in the first or outer one a narrow staircase, leading to two more above. These last were fitted up as bedchambers. Neither in them, nor in the rooms below, was any scarcity of convenient furniture observable, although the fittings were of a bygone fashion, but solitude and want of use seemed to have rendered it unfit for any purposes of comfort, and to have given it a grisly, haunted air. Movables of every kind lay strewn about, without the least attempt at order, and were intermixed with boxes, hampers, and all sorts of lumber. On all the floors were piles of books, to the amount, perhaps, of some thousands of volumes. These, still in bales, those, wrapped in paper, as they had been purchased, others scattered singly or in heaps, not one upon the shelves which lined the walls. To these Mr. Phipps called Tom's attention. Before anything else can be done, we must have them put in order, catalogued, and ranged upon the bookshelves, Mr. Pinch. That will do to begin with, I think, sir. Apostrophe, Tom rubbed his hands in the pleasant anticipation of a task so congenial to his taste, and said, an occupation full of interest for me, I assure you. It will occupy me, perhaps, until Mr. Apostrophe repeated Phipps, as much as to ask Tom what he was stopping for. I forgot that you had not mentioned the gentleman's name, apostrophe said Tom. Oh, apostrophe, cried Mr. Phipps, pulling on his glove, didn't I? No, by the by, I don't think I did. Ah, I dare say he'll be here soon. You will get on very well together, I have no doubt. I wish you success, I am sure. You won't forget to shut the door? It'll lock of itself, if you slam it. 9:30, you know. Let us say from 9:30 to 4, or 4, or thereabouts. One day, perhaps, a little earlier, another day, perhaps, a little later, according as you feel disposed, and as you arrange your work. Mr. Phipps, Austin Friars, of course you'll remember? And you won't forget to slam the door, if you please. Apostrophe, he said all this in such a comfortable, easy manner, that Tom could only rub his hands, and nod his head, and smile in acquiescence, which he was still doing, when Mr. Phipps walked coolly out. Why, he's gone. Apostrophe, cried Tom. And what's more, Tom, apostrophe said John Westlock, seating himself upon a pile of books, and looking up at his astonished friend, he is evidently not coming back again, so here you are, installed. Under rather singular circumstances, Tom, apostrophe, it was such an odd affair throughout, and Tom standing there among the books with his hat in one hand, and the key in the other, looked so prodigiously confounded, that his friend could not help laughing heartily. Tom himself was tickled, no less by the hilarity of his friend than by the recollection of the sudden manner in which he had been brought to a stop, in the very height of his urbane conference with Mr. Phipps. So by degrees Tom burst out laughing too, and each making the other laugh more, they fairly roared. When they had had their laugh out, which did not happen very soon, for give John an inch, that way and he was sure to take several ells, being a jovial, good-tempered fellow, they looked about them more closely, groping among the lumber for any stray means of enlightenment that might turn up. But no scrap or shred of information could they find. The books were marked with a variety of owners' names, having, no doubt, been bought at sales, and collected here and there at different times, but whether any one of these names belonged to Tom's employer, and, if so, which of them, they had no means whatever of determining. It occurred to John as a very bright thought to make inquiry at the steward's office, to whom the chambers belonged, or by whom they were held, but he came back no wiser than he went, the answer being, Mr. Phipps, of Austin Friars. Apostrophe, after all, Tom, I begin to think it lies no deeper than this. Phipps is an eccentric man, has some knowledge of Pecksniff, despises him, of course, has heard or seen enough of you to know that you are the man he wants, and engages you in his own whimsical manner. Apostrophe, but why in his own whimsical manner? Apostrophe, asked Tom. Oh, why does any man entertain his own whimsical taste? Why does Mr. Phipps wear shorts and powder, and Mr. Phipps' next door neighbor boots and a wig? Apostrophe, Tom, being in that state of mind in which any explanation is a great relief, adopted this last one, which indeed was quite as feasible as any other, readily, and said he had no doubt of it. Nor was his faith at all shaken by his having said exactly the same thing to each suggestion of his friends in turn, and being perfectly ready to say it again, if he had any new solution to propose. As he had not, Tom drew down the window sash, and folded the shutter, and they left the rooms. He closed the door heavily, as Mr. Phipps had desired him, tried it, found it all safe, and put the key in his pocket. They made a pretty wide circuit in going back to Islington, as they had time to spare, and Tom was never tired of looking about him. It was well he had John Westlock for his companion, for most people would have been weary of his perpetual stoppages at shop windows, and his frequent dashes into the crowded carriageway at the peril of his life, to get the better view of church steeples, and other public buildings. But John was charmed to see him so much interested, and every time Tom came back with a beaming face from among the wheels of carts and hackney coaches, wholly unconscious of the personal congratulations addressed to him by the drivers, John seemed to like him better than before. There was no flower on Ruth's hands when she received them in the triangular parlor, but there were pleasant smiles upon her face, and a crowd of welcomes shining out of every smile, and gleaming in her bright eyes. By the by, how bright they were! Looking into them for but a moment, when you took her hand, you saw, in each, such a capital miniature of yourself, representing you as such a restless, flashing, eager, brilliant little fellow. Ah, if you could only have kept them for your own miniature. But, wicked, roving, restless, to impartial eyes, it was enough for anyone to stand before them, and, straightway, there he danced and sparkled quite as merrily as you. The table was already spread for dinner, and though it was spread with nothing very choice in the way of glass or linen, and with green-handled knives, and very mountebanks of two-pronged forks, which seemed to be trying how far asunder they could possibly stretch their legs without converting themselves into double the number of iron toothpicks, it wanted neither damask, silver, gold, nor china, no, nor any other garniture at all. There it was, and, being there, nothing else would have done as well. The success of that initiative dish, that first experiment of hers in cookery, was so entire, so unalloyed and perfect, that John Westlock and Tom agreed she must have been studying the art in secret for a long time past, and urged her to make a full confession of the fact. They were exceedingly merry over this jest, and many smart things were said concerning it. But John was not as fair in his behavior as might have been expected, for, after luring Tom Pynchon for a long time, he suddenly went over to the enemy, and swore to everything his sister said. However, as Tom observed the same night, before going to bed, it was only in joke, and John had always been famous for being polite to ladies, even when he was quite a boy. Ruth said, "Oh, indeed." Apostrophe, she didn't say anything else. It is astonishing how much three people may find to talk about. They scarcely left off talking once. And it was not all lively chat which occupied them, for when Tom related how he had seen Mr. Pecksniff's daughters, and what a change had fallen on the younger, they were very serious. John Westlock became quite absorbed in her fortunes, asking many questions of Tom Pinch about her marriage, inquiring whether her husband was the gentleman whom Tom had brought to dine with him at Salisbury, in what degree of relationship they stood towards each other, being different persons, and taking, in short, the greatest interest in the subject. Tom then went into it at full length. He told how Martin had gone abroad, and had not been heard of for a long time, how Dragon Mark had borne him company, how Mr. Pecksniff had got the poor old doting grandfather into his power, and how he basely sought the hand of Mary Graham. But not a word said Tom of what lay hidden in his heart, so deep, and true, and full of honor, and yet with so much room for every gentle and unselfish thought, not a word. Tom, Tom, the man in all this world most confident in his sagacity and shrewdness, the man in all this world most proud of his distrust of other men, and having most to show in gold and silver as the gains belonging to his creed, the meekest favorer of that wise doctrine, every man for himself, and God for us all,
there being high wisdom in the thought that the eternal majesty of heaven ever was, or can be, on the side of selfish lust and love.
Semicolon shall never find, oh, never find, be sure of that, the time come home to him, when all his wisdom is an idiot's folly, weighed against a simple heart. Well, well, Tom, it was simple to, though simple in a different way, to be so eager touching that same theater, of which John said, when he was done, he had the absolute command, so far as taking parties in without the payment of a sixpence was concerned. And simpler yet, perhaps, never to suspect that, when he went in first, alone, he paid the money. Simple in thee, dear Tom, to laugh and cry so heartily at such a sorry show, so poorly shown. Simple to be so happy, and loquacious trudging home with Ruth. Simple to be so surprised to find that Mary present of a cookery book awaiting her in the parlor next morning, with the beefsteak pudding leaf turned down and blotted out. There. Let the record stand. Thy quality of soul was simple, simple, quite contemptible, Tom Pinch. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.